The Little Lame Prince, Chapter 1. Yes, he was the most beautiful prince that ever was born. Of course, being a prince, people said this, but it was true besides. When he looked at the candle, his eyes had an expression of earnest inquiry quite startling in a newborn baby. His nose there was not much of it certainly, but what there was seemed an aquiline shape. His complexion was a charming, healthy purple, he was round and fat, straight-limbed and long in fact, a splendid baby. And everybody was exceedingly proud of him, especially his father and mother, the king and queen of No Man's Land, who had waited for him during their happy reign of 10 years now made happier than ever, to themselves and their subjects, by the appearance of a son and heir. The only person who was not quite happy was the king's brother, the heir presumptive, who would have been king one day had the baby not been born. But as his majesty was very kind to him, and even rather sorry for him insomuch that at the queen's request he gave him a dukedom almost as big as a county, the crown prince, as he was called, tried to seem pleased also, and let us hope he succeeded. The prince's christening was to be a grand affair. According to the custom of the country, there were chosen for him 24 godfathers and godmothers, who each had to give him a name, and promised to do their utmost for him. When he came of age, he himself had to choose the name and the godfather or godmother that he liked the best, for the rest of his days. Meantime all was rejoicing. Subscriptions were made among the rich to give pleasure to the poor, dinners in town halls for the working men, tea parties in the streets for their wives, and milk and bun feasts for the children in the schoolrooms. For No Man's Land, though I cannot point it out in any map, or read of it in any history, was, I believe, much like our own or many another country. As for the palace, which was no different from other palaces, it was clean turned out of the windows, as people say, with the preparations going on. The only quiet place in it was the room which, though the prince was 6 weeks old, his mother the queen had never quitted. Nobody said she was ill, however it would have been so inconvenient, and as she said nothing about it herself, but lay pale and placid, giving no trouble to anybody, nobody thought much about her. All the world was absorbed in admiring the baby. The christening day came at last, and it was as lovely as the prince himself. All the people in the palace were lovely too, or thought themselves so in the elegant new clothes which the queen, who thought of everybody, had taken care to give them, from the ladies in waiting down to the poor little kitchen maid, who looked at herself in her pink cotton gown, and thought, doubtless, that there never was such a pretty girl as she. By 6 in the morning all the royal household had dressed itself in its very best, and then the little prince was dressed in his best, his magnificent christening robe, which preceding his royal highness did not like at all, but kicked and screamed like any common baby. When he had a little calmed down, they carried him to be looked at by the queen his mother, who, though her royal robes had been brought and laid upon the bed, was, as everybody well knew, quite unable to rise and put them on. She admired her baby very much, kissed and blessed him, and lay looking at him, as she did for hours sometimes, when he was placed beside her fast asleep. Then she gave him up with a gentle smile, and, saying she hoped he would be very good, that it would be a very nice christening, and all the guests would enjoy themselves, turned peacefully over on her bed, saying nothing more to anybody. She was a very uncomplaining person, the queen, and her name was Dolores. Everything went on exactly as if she had been present. All, even the king himself, had grown used to her absence, for she was not strong, and for years had not joined in any gaieties. She always did her royal duties, but as to pleasures, they could go on quite well without her, or it seemed so. The company arrived, great and notable persons in this and neighboring countries, also the 24 godfathers and godmothers, who had been chosen with care, as the people who would be most useful to his royal highness should he ever want friends, which did not seem likely. What such want could possibly happen to the heir of the powerful monarch of No Man's Land? They came, walking two and two, with their coronets on their heads, being dukes and duchesses, princes and princesses, or the like. They all kissed the child and pronounced the name each had given him. Then the 24 names were shouted out with great energy by 6 heralds, one after the other, and afterward written down, to be preserved in the state records, in readiness for the next time they were wanted, which would be either on his royal highness' coronation or his funeral. Soon the ceremony was over, and everybody satisfied, except, perhaps, the little prince himself, who moaned faintly under his christening robes, which nearly smothered him. In truth, though very few knew, the prince in coming to the chapel had met with a slight disaster. His nurse, not his ordinary one, but the state nursemaid, an elegant and fashionable young lady of rank, whose duty it was to carry him to and from the chapel, had been so occupied in arranging her train with one hand, while she held the baby with the other, that she stumbled and let him fall, just at the foot of the marble staircase. To be sure, she contrived to pick him up again the next minute, and the accident was so slight it seemed hardly worth speaking of. Consequently, nobody did speak of it. The baby had turned deadly pale, but did not cry, so no person a step or two behind could discover anything wrong. Afterward, even if he had moaned, the silver trumpets were loud enough to drown his voice. It would have been a pity to let anything trouble such a day of felicity. So, after a minute's pause, the procession had moved on. Such a procession tea heralds in blue and silver, pages in crimson and gold, and a troop of little girls in dazzling white, carrying baskets of flowers, which they strewed all the way before the nurse and child. Finally the 24 godfathers and godmothers, as proud as possible, and so splendid to look at that they would have quite extinguished their small godson merely a heap of lace and muslin with a baby face inside had it not been for a canopy of white satin and ostrich feathers which was held over him wherever he was carried. Thus, with the sun shining on them through the painted windows, they stood, the king and his train on one side, the prince and his attendants on the other, as pretty a sight as ever was seen out of fairyland. "It's just like fairyland," whispered the eldest little girl to the next eldest, as she shook the last rose out of her basket, "and I think the only thing the prince wants now is a fairy godmother."
"Does he?" said a shrill but soft and not unpleasant voice behind, and there was seen among the group of children somebody, not a child, yet no bigger than a child, somebody whom nobody had seen before, and who certainly had not been invited, for she had no christening clothes on. She was a little old woman dressed all in grey, grey gown, grey hooded cloak, of a material excessively fine, and a tint that seemed perpetually changing, like the grey of an evening sky. Her hair was grey, and her eyes also, even her complexion had a soft grey shadow over it. But there was nothing unpleasantly old about her, and her smile was as sweet and childlike as the prince's own, which stole over his pale little face the instant she came near enough to touch him.
"Take care. Don't let the baby fall again." The grand young lady nurse started, flushing angrily. "Who spoke to me? How did anybody know? I mean, what business has anybody?" Then frightened, but still speaking in a much sharper tone than "I hope young ladies of rank are in the habit of speaking old woman, you will be kind enough not to say the baby, but the prince. Keep away, his royal highness is just going to sleep. Nevertheless I must kiss him. I am his godmother."
"You!" cried the elegant lady nurse.
"You!"
repeated all the gentlemen and ladies in waiting.
"You!" echoed the heralds and pages, and they began to blow the silver trumpets in order to stop all further conversation. The prince's procession formed itself for returning, the king and his train having already moved off toward the palace, but on the topmost step of the marble stairs stood, right in front of all, the little old woman clothed in grey. She stretched herself on tiptoe by the help of her stick, and gave the little prince three kisses.
"This is intolerable," cried the young lady nurse, wiping the kisses off rapidly with her lace handkerchief. "Such an insult to his royal highness. Take yourself out of the way, old woman, or the king shall be informed immediately."
"The king knows nothing of me, more's the pity," replied the old woman, with an indifferent air, as if she thought the loss was more on his majesty's side than hers. "My friend in the palace is the king's wife."
"Kings have not wives, but queens," said the lady nurse, with a contemptuous air.
"You are right," replied the old woman. "Nevertheless I know her majesty well, and I love her and her child. And since you dropped him on the marble stairs," this she said in a mysterious whisper, which made the young lady tremble in spite of her anger, "I choose to take him for my own, and be his godmother, ready to help him whenever he wants me."
"You help him?" cried all the group, breaking into shouts of laughter, to which the little old woman paid not the slightest attention. Her soft grey eyes were fixed on the prince, who seemed to answer to the look, smiling again and again in the causeless, aimless fashion that babies do smile.
"His majesty must hear of this," said a gentleman in waiting.
"His majesty will hear quite enough news in a minute or two," said the old woman sadly. And again stretching up to the little prince, she kissed him on the forehead solemnly. "Be called by a new name which nobody has ever thought of. Be Prince Dolor, in memory of your mother Dolores."
"In memory of?" Everybody started at the ominous phrase, and also at a most terrible breach of etiquette which the old woman had committed. In no man's land, neither the king nor the queen was supposed to have any Christian name at all. They dropped it on their coronation day, and it never was mentioned again till it was engraved on their coffins when they died.
"Old woman," "You are exceedingly ill-bred," cried the eldest lady-in-waiting, much horrified. "How you could know the fact passes my comprehension. But even if you did know it, how dared you presume to hint that Her Most Gracious Majesty is called Dolores?"
"Was called Dolores," said the old woman, with a tender solemnity. The first gentleman, called the gold stick-in-waiting, raised it to strike her, and all the rest stretched out their hands to seize her, but the gray mantle melted from between their fingers like hair, and, before anybody had time to do anything more, there came a heavy, muffled, startling sound. The great bell of the palace, the bell which was only heard on the death of someone of the royal family, and for as many times as he or she was years old, began to toll. They listened, mute and horror-stricken. Someone counted, 1, 2, 3, 4 up to 29, just the queen's age. It was, indeed, the queen. Her majesty was dead. In the midst of the festivities she had slipped away out of her new happiness and her old sufferings, not few nor small. Sending away all her women to see the grand sight, at least they said afterward, in excuse, that she had done so, and it was very like her to do it, she had turned with her face to the window, whence one could just see the tops of the distant mountains, the beautiful mountains, as they were called where she was born. So gazing, she had quietly died. When the little prince was carried back to his mother's room, there was no mother to kiss him. And, though he did not know it, there would be for him no mother's kiss anymore. As for his godmother, the little old woman in gray who called herself so, whether she melted into air, like her gown when they touched it, or whether she flew out of the chapel window, or slipped through the doorway among the bewildered crowd, nobody knew, nobody ever thought about her. Only the nurse, the ordinary homely one, coming out of the prince's nursery in the middle of the night in search of a cordial to quiet his continual moans, saw, sitting in the doorway, something which she would have thought a mere shadow, had she not seen shining out of it two eyes, gray and soft and sweet. She put her hand before her own, screaming loudly. When she took them away, the old woman was gone. Chapter 2. Everybody was very kind to the poor little prince. I think people generally are kind to motherless children, whether princes or peasants. He had a magnificent nursery and a regular suite of attendants, and was treated with the greatest respect and state. Nobody was allowed to talk to him in silly baby language, or dandle him, or, above all, to kiss him, though perhaps some people did it surreptitiously, for he was such a sweet baby that it was difficult to help it. It could not be said that the prince missed his mother. Children of his age cannot do that, but somehow after she died everything seemed to go wrong with him. From a beautiful baby he became sickly and pale, seeming to have almost ceased growing, especially in his legs, which had been so fat and strong. But after the day of his christening they withered and shrank, he no longer kicked them out either in passion or play, and when, as he got to be nearly a year old, his nurse tried to make him stand upon them, he only tumbled down. This happened so many times that at last people began to talk about it. A prince, and not able to stand on his own legs. What a dreadful thing! What a misfortune for the country! Rather a misfortune to him also, poor little boy. But nobody seemed to think of that. And when, after a while, his health revived, and the old bright look came back to his sweet little face, and his body grew larger and stronger, though still his legs remained the same, people continued to speak of him in whispers, and with grave shakes of the head. Everybody knew, though nobody said it, that something, it was impossible to guess what, was not quite right with the poor little prince. Of course, nobody hinted this to the king his father, it does not do to tell great people anything unpleasant. And besides, his majesty took very little notice of his son, or of his other affairs, beyond the necessary duties of his kingdom. People had said he would not miss the queen at all, she having been so long an invalid, but he did. After her death he never was quite the same. He established himself in her empty rooms, the only rooms in the palace whence one could see the beautiful mountains, and was often observed looking at them as if he thought she had flown away thither, and that his longing could bring her back again. And by a curious coincidence, which nobody dared inquire into, he desired that the prince might be called, not by any of the 24 grand names given him by his godfathers and godmothers, but by the identical name mentioned by the little old woman in gray, Dolor, after his mother Dolores. Once a week, according to established state custom, the prince, dressed in his very best, was brought to the king his father for half an hour, but his majesty was generally too ill and too melancholy to pay much heed to the child. Only once, when he and the crown prince, who was exceedingly attentive to his royal brother, were sitting together, with Prince Dolor playing in a corner of the room, dragging himself about with his arms rather than his legs, and sometimes trying feebly to crawl from one chair to another,
It seemed to strike the father that all was not right with his son. "How old is His Royal Highness?" said he suddenly to the nurse.
2 years, 3 months, and 5 days, please your majesty."
"It does not please me," said the king, with a sigh. "He ought to be far more forward than he is now, ought he not, brother? You, who have so many children, must know. Is there not something wrong about him?"
"Oh, no," said the crown prince, exchanging meaning looks with the nurse, who did not understand at all, but stood frightened and trembling with the tears in her eyes. "Nothing to make your majesty at all uneasy. No doubt His Royal Highness will outgrow it in time."
"Outgrow what?"
"A slight delicacy, ahem. In the spine, something inherited, perhaps, from his dear mother. Ah, she was always delicate, but she was the sweetest woman that ever lived. Come here, my little son." And as the prince turned round upon his father a small, sweet, grave face, so like his mother's, His Majesty the King smiled and held out his arms. But when the boy came to him, not running like a boy, but wriggling awkwardly along the floor, the royal countenance clouded over. "I ought to have been told of this. It is terrible, terrible. And for a prince too. Send for all the doctors in my kingdom immediately." They came, and each gave a different opinion and ordered a different mode of treatment. The only thing they agreed in was what had been pretty well known before, that the prince must have been hurt when he was an infant, let fall, perhaps, so as to injure his spine and lower limbs. Did nobody remember?
No, nobody. Indignantly, all the nurses denied that any such accident had happened, was possible to have happened, until the faithful country nurse recollected that it really had happened on the day of the christening. For which unluckily good memory all the others scolded her so severely that she had no peace of her life, and soon after, by the influence of the young lady nurse who had carried the baby that fatal day, and who was a sort of connection of the crown prince being his wife's second cousin once removed, the poor woman was pensioned off and sent to the beautiful mountains from whence she came, with orders to remain there for the rest of her days. But of all this the king knew nothing, for, indeed, after the first shock of finding out that his son could not walk, and seemed never likely to, he interfered very little concerning him. The whole thing was too painful, and His Majesty never liked painful things. Sometimes he inquired after Prince Stoller, and they told him His Royal Highness was going on as well as could be expected, which really was the case. For, after worrying the poor child and perplexing themselves with one remedy after another, the Crown Prince, not wishing to offend any of the differing doctors, had proposed leaving him to nature, and nature, the safest doctor of all, had come to his help and done her best. He could not walk, it is true, his limbs were mere useless appendages to his body, but the body itself was strong and sound. And his face was the same as ever, just his mother's face, one of the sweetest in the world. Even the king, indifferent as he was, sometimes looked at the little fellow with sad tenderness, noticing how cleverly he learned to crawl and swing himself about by his arms, so that in his own awkward way he was as active in motion as most children of his age. "Poor little man. He does his best, and he is not unhappy, not half so unhappy as I, brother," addressing the crown prince, who was more constant than ever in his attendance upon the sick monarch. "If anything should befall me, I have appointed you regent. In case of my death, you will take care of my poor little boy?"
"Certainly, certainly, but do not let us imagine any such misfortune. I assure your majesty, everybody will assure you that it is not in the least likely." He knew, however, and everybody knew, that it was likely, and soon after it actually did happen. The king died as suddenly and quietly as the queen had done indeed, in her very room and bed, and Prince Stoller was left without either father or mother, as sad a thing as could happen, even to a prince. He was more than that now, though. He was a king. In no man's land, as in other countries, the people were struck with grief one day and revived the next. "The king is dead, long live the king," was the cry that rang through the nation, and almost before His late majesty had been laid beside the queen in their splendid mausoleum, crowds came thronging from all parts to the royal palace, eager to see the new monarch. They did see him, the prince regent took care they should, sitting on the floor of the council chamber, sucking his thumb. And when one of the gentlemen in waiting lifted him up and carried him, fancy carrying a king, to the chair of state, and put the crown on his head, he shook it off again, it was so heavy and uncomfortable. Sliding down to the foot of the throne, he began playing with the golden lions that supported it, stroking their paws and putting his tiny fingers into their eyes, and laughing as if he had at last found something to amuse him. "There's a fine king for you," said the first lord in waiting, a friend of the prince regent's, the crown prince that used to be, who, in the deepest mourning, stood silently beside the throne of his young nephew. He was a handsome man, very grand and clever looking. What a king! Who can never stand to receive his subjects, never walk in processions, who to the last day of his life will have to be carried about like a baby. Very unfortunate.
Exceedingly unfortunate, repeated the second lord. It is always bad for a nation when its king is a child, but such a child a permanent cripple, if not worse.
Let us hope not worse, said the first lord in a very hopeless tone, and looking toward the regent, who stood erect and pretended to hear nothing. I have heard that these sort of children with very large heads, and great broad foreheads and staring eyes, are well, let us hope for the best and be prepared for the worst. In the meantime,
I swear, said the crown prince, coming forward and kissing the hilt of his sword, I swear to perform my duties as regent, to take all care of His Royal Highness His Majesty, with a grand bow to the little child, who laughed innocently back again. And I will do my humble best to govern the country. Still, if the country has the slightest objection. But the crown prince being generalissimo, having the whole army at his beck and call, so that he could have begun a civil war in no time, the country had, of course, not the slightest objection. So the king and queen slept together in peace, and Prince Dolor reigned over the land, that is, his uncle did, and everybody said what a fortunate thing it was for the poor little prince to have such a clever uncle to take care of him. All things went on as usual, indeed, after the regent had brought his wife and her seven sons, and established them in the palace, rather better than usual. For they gave such splendid entertainments and made the capital so lively that trade revived, and the country was said to be more flourishing than it had been for a century. Whenever the regent and his sons appeared, they were received with shouts, "Long live the crown prince! Long live the royal family!" And, in truth, they were very fine children, the whole seven of them, and made a great show when they rode out together on seven beautiful horses, one height above another, down to the youngest, on his tiny black pony, no bigger than a large dog. As for the other child, His Royal Highness Prince Dolor, for somehow people soon ceased to call him His Majesty, which seemed such a ridiculous title for a poor little fellow, a helpless cripple, with only head and trunk, and no legs to speak of, he was seen very seldom by anybody. Sometimes people daring enough to peer over the high wall of the palace garden noticed there, carried in a footman's arms, or drawn in a chair, or left to play on the grass, often with nobody to mind him, a pretty little boy, with a bright, intelligent face and large, melancholy eyes. No, not exactly melancholy, for they were his mother's, and she was by no means sad-minded, but thoughtful and dreamy. They rather perplexed people, those childish eyes, they were so exceedingly innocent and yet so penetrating. If anybody did a wrong thing, told a lie, for instance, they would turn round with such a grave, silent surprise. The child never talked much that every naughty person in the palace was rather afraid of Prince Dolor. He could not help it, and perhaps he did not even know it, being no better a child than many other children, but there was something about him which made bad people sorry, and grumbling people ashamed of themselves, and ill-natured people gentle and kind. I suppose because they were touched to see a poor little fellow who did not in the least know what had befallen him or what lay before him, living his baby life as happy as the day is long. Thus, whether or not he was good himself, the sight of him and his affliction made other people good, and, above all, made everybody love him so much so, that his uncle the regent began to feel a little uncomfortable. Now, I have nothing to say against uncles in general. They are usually very excellent people, and very convenient to little boys and girls. Even the cruel uncle of the babes in the wood I believe to be quite an exceptional character. And this cruel uncle of whom I am telling was, I hope, an exception, too. He did not mean to be cruel. If anybody had called him so, he would have resented it extremely, he would have said that what he did was done entirely for the good of the country. But he was a man who had always been accustomed to consider himself first and foremost, believing that whatever he wanted was sure to be right, and therefore he ought to have it. So he tried to get it, and got it too, as people like him very often do. Whether they enjoy it when they have it is another question. Therefore he went one day to the council chamber, determined on making a speech, and informing the ministers and the country at large that the young king was in failing health, and that it would be advisable to send him for a time to the beautiful mountains. Whether he really meant to do this, or whether it occurred to him afterward that there would be an easier way of attaining his great desire, the crown of no man's land, is a point which I cannot decide. But soon after, when he had obtained an order in council to send the king away, which was done in great state, with a guard of honor composed of two whole regiments of soldiers, the nation learned, without much surprise,
that the poor little prince nobody ever called him king now had gone a much longer journey than to the beautiful mountains. He had fallen ill on the road and died within a few hours, at least so declared the physician in attendance and the nurse who had been sent to take care of him. They brought his coffin back in great state, and buried it in a mausoleum with his parents. So Prince Dolor was seen no more. The country went into deep mourning for him, and then forgot him, and his uncle reigned in his stead. That illustrious personage accepted his crown with great decorum, and wore it with great dignity to the last. But whether he enjoyed it or not there is no evidence to show. Chapter 3. And what of the little lame prince, whom everybody seemed so easily to have forgotten? Not everybody. There were a few kind souls, mothers of families, who had heard his sad story, and some servants about the palace, who had been familiar with his sweet ways these many a time sighed and said, "Poor Prince Dolor." Or, looking at the beautiful mountains, which were visible all over No Man's Land, though few people ever visited them, well, perhaps His Royal Highness is better where he is than even there. They did not know indeed, hardly anybody did know that beyond the mountains, between them and the sea, lay a tract of country, barren, level, bare, except for short, stunted grass, and here and there a patch of tiny flowers. Not a bush, not a tree, not a resting place for bird or beast was in that dreary plain. In summer the sunshine fell upon it hour after hour with a blinding glare, in winter the winds and rain swept over it unhindered, and the snow came down steadily, noiselessly, covering it from end to end in one great white sheet, which lay for days and weeks unmarked by a single footprint. Not a pleasant place to live in, and nobody did live there, apparently. The only sign that human creatures had ever been near the spot was one large round tower which rose up in the center of the plain, and might be seen all over it if there had been anybody to see, which there never was. Rose right up out of the ground, as if it had grown of itself, like a mushroom. But it was not at all mushroom-like, on the contrary, it was very solidly built. In form it resembled the Irish round towers, which have puzzled people for so long, nobody being able to find out when, or by whom, or for what purpose they were made, seemingly for no use at all, like this tower. It was circular, of very firm brickwork, with neither doors nor windows, until near the top, when you could perceive some slits in the wall through which one might possibly creep in or look out. Its height was nearly 100 feet, and it had a battlemented parapet showing sharp against the sky. As the plain was quite desolate, almost like a desert, only without sand, and led to nowhere except the still more desolate seacoast, nobody ever crossed it. Whatever mystery there was about the tower, it and the sky and the plain kept their secret to themselves. It was a very great secret indeed, a state secret, which none but so clever a man as the present king of No Man's Land would ever have thought of. How he carried it out, undiscovered, I cannot tell. People said, long afterward, that it was by means of a gang of condemned criminals, who were set to work, and executed immediately after they had done, so that nobody knew anything, or in the least suspected the real fact. And what was the fact? Why, that this tower, which seemed a mere mass of masonry, utterly forsaken and uninhabited, was not so at all. Within 20 feet of the top some ingenious architect had planned a perfect little house, divided into 4 rooms as by drawing a cross within a circle you will see might easily be done. By making skylights, and a few slits in the walls for windows, and raising a peaked roof which was hidden by the parapet, here was a dwelling complete, 80 feet from the ground, and as inaccessible as a rook's nest on the top of a tree. A charming place to live in. If you once got up there, and never wanted to come down again. Inside, though nobody could have looked inside except a bird, and hardly even a bird flew past that lonely tower inside, it was furnished with all the comfort and elegance imaginable, with lots of books and toys, and everything that the heart of a child could desire. For its only inhabitant, except a nurse of course, was a poor solitary child. One winter night, when all the plain was white with moonlight, there was seen crossing it a great tall black horse, ridden by a man also big and equally black, carrying before him on the saddle a woman and a child. The woman, she had a sad, fierce look, and no wonder, for she was a criminal under sentence of death, but her sentence had been changed to almost as severe a punishment. She was to inhabit the lonely tower with the child, and was allowed to live as long as the child lived no longer. This in order that she might take the utmost care of him, for those who put him there were equally afraid of his dying and of his living. Yet he was only a little gentle boy, with a sweet, sleepy smile. He had been very tired with his long journey and clinging arms, which held tight to the man's neck, for he was rather frightened, and the face, black as it was, looked kindly at him. And he was very helpless, with his poor, small shriveled legs, which could neither stand nor run away for the little forlorn boy was Prince Dolor. He had not been dead at all or buried either. His grand funeral had been a mere pretense, a wax figure having been put in his place, while he himself was spirited away under charge of these two, the condemned woman and the black man. The latter was deaf and dumb, so could neither tell nor repeat anything. When they reached the foot of the tower, there was light enough to see a huge chain dangling from the parapet, but dangling only halfway. The deaf mute took from his saddle wallet a sort of ladder, arranged in pieces like a puzzle, fitted it together, and lifted it up to meet the chain. Then he mounted to the top of the tower, and slung from it a sort of chair, in which the woman and the child placed themselves and were drawn up, never to come down again as long as they lived. Leaving them there, the man descended the ladder, took it to pieces again and packed it in his pack, mounted the horse and disappeared across the plain. Every month they used to watch for him, appearing like a speck in the distance. He fastened his horse to the foot of the tower, and climbed it, as before, laden with provisions and many other things. He always saw the prince, so as to make sure that the child was alive and well, and then went away until the following month. While his first childhood lasted, Prince Dolor was happy enough. He had every luxury that even a prince could need, and the one thing wanting, love, never having known, he did not miss. His nurse was very kind to him, though she was a wicked woman. But either she had not been quite so wicked as people said, or she grew better through being shut up continually with a little innocent child who was dependent upon her for every comfort and pleasure of his life. It was not an unhappy life. There was nobody to tease or ill-use him, and he was never ill. He played about from room to room. There were four rooms, parlor, kitchen, his nurse's bedroom, and his own, learned to crawl like a fly, and to jump like a frog, and to run about on all fours almost as fast as a puppy. In fact, he was very much like a puppy or a kitten, as thoughtless and as merry, scarcely ever cross, though sometimes a little weary. As he grew older, he occasionally liked to be quiet for a while, and then he would sit at the slits of windows which were, however, much bigger than they looked from the bottom of the tower and watch the sky above and the ground below, with the storm sweeping over and the sunshine coming and going, and the shadows of the clouds running races across the blank plain. By and by he began to learn lessons, not that his nurse had been ordered to teach him, but she did it partly to amuse herself. She was not a stupid woman, and Prince Dolor was by no means a stupid boy, so they got on very well, and his continual entreaty, "What can I do? What can you find me to do?" was stopped, at least for an hour or two in the day. It was a dull life, but he had never known any other, anyhow, he remembered no other, and he did not pity himself at all. Not for a long time, till he grew quite a big little boy, and could read quite easily. Then he suddenly took to books, which the deaf mute brought him from time to time, books which, not being acquainted with the literature of No Man's Land, I cannot describe, but no doubt they were very interesting, and they informed him of everything in the outside world, and filled him with an intense longing to see it. From this time a change came over the boy. He began to look sad and thin, and to shut himself up for hours without speaking. For his nurse hardly spoke, and whatever questions he asked beyond their ordinary daily life she never answered. She had, indeed, been forbidden, on pain of death, to tell him anything about himself, who he was, or what he might have been. He knew he was Prince Dolor, because she always addressed him as "My Prince" and "Your Royal Highness," but what a prince was he had not the least idea. He had no idea of anything in the world, except what he found in his books. He sat one day surrounded by them, having built them up round him like a little castle wall. He had been reading them half the day, but feeling all the while that to read about things which you never can see is like hearing about a beautiful dinner while you are starving. For almost the first time in his life he grew melancholy, his hands fell on his lap, he sat gazing out of the window slit upon the view outside, the view he had looked at every day of his life, and might look at for endless days more. Not a very cheerful view, just the plain and the sky, but he liked it. He used to think, if he could only fly out of that window, up to the sky or down to the plain, how nice it would be. Perhaps when he died his nurse had told him once in anger that he would never leave the tower till he died, he might be able to do this. Not that he understood much what dying meant, but it must be a change, and any change seemed to him a blessing. "And I wish I had somebody to tell me all about it, about that and many other things, somebody that would be fond of me, like my poor white kitten." Here the tears came into his eyes, for the boy's one friend, the one interest of his life, had been a little white kitten, which the deaf mute, kindly smiling, once took out of his pocket.